It lives to kill, a mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws.
I saw Jaws when I was a kid in the 70s. I remember the audience in the cinema was actually screaming during the opening scene when the hippie girl gets mauled and dragged under the water. So why would a great white shark act like that? Why would it attack humans in that nice little seaside town so relentlessly, in a place that was called Amity? The answer was obvious. Because it's evil and it hates us. You heard the man in the trailer. It's as if God created the devil and gave him jaws. Yes, it's all about us. Well, now we know that that's actually a tiny bit narcissistic. What if the Great White isn't on a jihad against us humans? What if the Great White doesn't see us as much more than a distraction and a nuisance? This was James Woodford's experience among the sharks that swim in Australian waters. James is an author and a science journalist, and he describes the great white shark as not so much the devil incarnate, but as a supersized goldfish with an inner lion. James Woodford joined a crew of researchers diving at Neptune Islands, a world-renowned shark aggregation site off the coast of South Australia. He's written a book about his experiences that's called Great White. Hello, James.
G'day, Richard. How's it going?
Fine, thank you, sir. Did you see Jaws in the 1970s?
I did. And when I look back at it now, it's actually quite funny when you see the footage, because often the real sharks look quite robotic as well. It's sometimes when you see a really big shark, it's actually hard to believe that it is a real animal. They're just such an odd-looking thing.
Do you remember the attitudes in that film, which is, you know, still a hugely entertaining film, but Richard Dreyfuss, who plays the marine biologist, he says, oh, we've got to kill this thing straight away. Things have changed since then, haven't they?
They have, and there's a great little backstory that I heard about the making of Jaws, where they needed to get some footage in South Australia, but they needed to make the sharks look particularly big. So they got a dwarf to actually be in the cage. But the thing is that the cage fell into the sea, and this small statured person refused to then have any part of this whole circus. So, yeah, there's plenty of backstories behind the Jaws myths.
Very wise, very wise. What was your first experience in the water with a shark?
My friends still tease me about this. I joined the Navy when I was 17 and ended up on a minesweeper doing a trip down Cape York with these Navy clearance divers. And there wasn't many mines to clear. So we were stopping all along the place and doing this fabulous snorkeling and visiting the resorts. Anyway, we pulled into a place called Michaelmas Cay and cast anchor. We all went ashore and we went snorkeling. And it was actually one of my very first times of properly snorkeling, and certainly my first time of seeing the Great Barrier Reef. And it was an experience that really impacted on me. But I was probably in about chest-deep water, and I got on the lookout for sharks. And I turned around, and I could see a little reef shark. And it was probably only about a metre and a half long. But I absolutely was terrified.
The human can levitate in such conditions, can't they?
And it's so, when I look back on it, it's so ridiculous. But I think it just shows how terrified Australians actually are. And my friend, who's still a guy called Paul Mogger, who's still in the Navy, he still ribs me about how fast I ran out of the water screaming shark.
It's a bit Looney Tunes cartoon, isn't it? You sort of levitate, the legs start to spin, yep, and then you're on land suddenly. Now, let's go a step further here. About your experience, first experience with a bull shark off the Great Barrier Reef in May 2010.
Yeah, so this was a really interesting experience, and I guess this is when things really started to change for me with sharks. I'd been diving for a couple of years before that, researching a book that I did on the Great Barrier Reef, and we'd seen a lot of sharks when you're diving on the reef, all various types of sharks, and we'd had some kind of close encounters with some big sharks, including a lemon shark at One Tree Island. But this particular day, we were 250 kilometres offshore from Mackay at a place called the Swains Reef. And we were on the outside of the reef, and I was with some scientists from the Australian Institute of Marine Science, and I was particularly diving with this woman called Petra Lundgren. Anyway, Petra and I, we were collecting coral samples, and this huge cloud of baitfish came all over us. And truly, it was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. And I was actually stopping and taking photos, and it was just like this cloud of rain droplets, and it actually blocked out the light, and it was truly staggeringly amazing thing. Just billions of fish. And then as it passed, swimming through the back of the bait ball were these giant trevally, and they were, and the sort of cloud was kind of parting. And anyway, the cloud left and we got back to our work, and then I looked just to the other side of Petra. And there was a 2.5-3 meter bull shark really, really close to the bottom and really close to us, sort of going in the opposite direction. So I tapped Petra on the leg, and she turned around. And but because it was swimming away, we just thought, you know, it's fine. And then probably 5 minutes later, the bait ball came back. And again, surrounded by all these billions of fish. And again, as it passed, the giant trevally were swimming through. And then behind the giant trevally were these bull sharks. There's probably half a dozen of them. Not all of them were bull sharks, but the bull sharks were the ones that, you know, we really noticed.
How big were these bull sharks?
We're talking 2.5-3 meter bull sharks. Yeah. So much bigger than, you know, my biggest male friends, you know, huge animals. And they were coming through and they were swimming straight at us and then kind of peeling off at the last second. And it was one of those moments because you imagine, you know, what am I going to do if ever I encounter a dangerous shark? Am I going to pull out my dive knife and stab this thing in the nose or poke it in the eyes? And you actually realize when you're in a situation like that, that there is nothing that you can do because you can't possibly swim away as fast as any fish. You can't do anything to escape. You're by far the biggest piece of protein and the slowest bit of protein that's there. And you could see these sharks. They could see that we were there, but they just went past us. And it was a moment for me that everything I had always believed about sharks just went poof. You know, and we got out of the water quickly because it is still always a really smart thing to get out of the water when you've got big sharks around. Climbed back into the inflatable, and it really had me pondering, you know, I just couldn't believe that nobody had gotten attacked. Not only were we not attacked, they weren't even interested in us.
Were your feelings hurt by that in
some way? You know, I wasn't going to say that, but I actually, in an early draft of the book, I did actually say that, you know, you do sort of feel a little bit ripped off that there wasn't some more drama, but it was like standing in a field in the savannah in Africa and having lions just race past and show you complete disdain.
Why? Why, as you say, you were the biggest bit of slow-moving protein right in front of them. Why did they ignore you?
Because humans in that kind of an environment are a very, very new phenomenon for sharks. They have not evolved. You know, people have only been scuba diving like that for the last 50 or 60 years. They have not, they've been around for hundreds of millions of years, and they're just not evolved to target humans as prey. There's even some scientists who think that sharks may actually find human flesh unpalatable. So they're just not chasing us. What they will say with a bull shark is it's much more dangerous if you're in murky water. So, you know, there has been incidents in Sydney Harbour, the Navy clearance diver who got bitten and lost an arm and a leg. And probably what happened there is it's just very poor water quality, and the fish just made a mistake.
Oh, it mistook the diver for a seal,
or,
in other words.
Or a fish or you know, just something. But the fact is, if sharks, like bull sharks and great whites and tiger sharks, had humans on their prey list, they'd all be down at Bondi Beach.
Of course, I suppose they would. You talk to kids in classes about sharks, and what do you ask them about what they think and what they know about shark attacks?
Yeah, I had a fascinating time last year talking to a group of students up on the north coast of New South Wales, and I said to them, okay, everybody, put your hands up, tell me how many people do you think get taken by sharks each year? And all these little arms went up, and I was absolutely stunned because there was, you know, one little boy said 5,000, a little girl 500, another little boy said 600, you know, all these absolutely outlandish figures. And the simple fact is that there is so few people actually get eaten and killed by sharks. So we're talking about an average of one fatality per year. And sure, there are years when we have spikes in that, but then there are years when there are none. So there's since 1791, there's only been 183 fatal unprovoked shark attacks in Australia.
How has the language about shark attacks changed since over the 20th century, for example?
Look, I actually found this, and I know it may seem a little esoteric, but it's actually really important. And I found this one of the most interesting things that I came across when I was researching this book. There's a guy called Dr. Christopher Neff at the University of Sydney, and he's looked into all of the language surrounding sharks and
like,
how that...
newspaper reports, that kind of
thing. Newspaper reports, the way that politicians and surf lifesavers and others talk about them. And what he was trying to find out is how we've kind of reached the place where we are now. Because at the end of the day, this is just a big wild animal. And what he actually discovered is that right through till about the 1930s and 40s, shark attacks weren't called shark attacks. They were called shark accidents. Shark accidents. So it was seen more that it was the fault of the swimmer. And so the opprobrium for something like that happening fell on the swimmer. And so there were actually quite large fines for people who were doing silly things out in the ocean. And then that has all really switched around. And there's a really interesting story about how that switched around as well.
Yeah. So the onus then of responsibility for being mauled by a shark was shifted.
Put on the shark. And so Chris...
like a criminal act.
Christopher's... way of describing it, he says that sharks have been criminalised. They've almost been made out to be murderous, like criminals in the same way that humans are. And the simple fact is they are just going about their business. And they do what they've always done, which play an incredibly important part in the Australian marine ecosystem. They're a totally critical thing to have in our environment.
It does seem a bit, you know, silly for us to take it so personally, isn't it? If you've endured a shark attack or you've been mauled by a shark, of course you are going to take that terribly seriously. But for the population at large to see it as you heard the voice over there, it's as if the devil, God created the devil and gave him jaws. It's all about us. They were put in the waters of this earth solely to attack us.
Yes.
It's all about us.
It is very human-centric. But having said that, you know, if you are that person, it's obviously for them and their families, it's a horrific thing to be bitten by a shark. And I experienced that earlier this year when there was a surf lifesaver and a husband and a group of other swimmers down at Tathra in New South Wales. And I was down there in the aftermath of that accident and just watching the way that people deal with the aftermath of a... And that was a very unusual case because she was completely consumed. There was a very few bits of remains, her swimming cap and her goggles. But the exact figure eludes me, but it's about 40 cases since European settlement of Australia where a person has been either partly or completely consumed, and she was one of those people. And watching this outpouring of fear and grief in that community was quite extraordinary.
What is on the shark's menu then? What are they looking to eat?
Oh, look, they're amazing animals. It depends on the shark. So you've got everything from wobbegongs, which can chow down on the hardest shells, through to tiger sharks, which can come in and actually bite through a turtle shell and consume the turtle shell. And the science behind how they do that is quite amazing. And then obviously a great white, they're eating. So one of the really interesting things about a great white is that up until they're about 3 meters in length, which most people would regard as an enormous shark, they're not really got the dentition to be attacking things like seals and people. And
they haven't got the teeth.
Their teeth actually change shape. They're quite thin, up to about 3 meters, and then it's after that size that their teeth actually become the big kind of famous spade-like things that we see, you know, on necklaces and in museums.
You were with a group of researchers off the Neptune Islands, and they had all sorts of fascinating names for sharks, like Cupcake and Buffy and
It was like a whole lot of pole dancers.
Yeah, I thought. Cupcake. I think that's a cute name for a shark.
Amelie and just all kinds of crazy names. Yeah.
Tell me about Buffy and what Buffy could do with his or her teeth. I'm not entirely sure.
The exact name, it's something like paleoquadrate protrusion. And what they can do, and it's that stereotypical ghoulish thing that a shark can do, where they can almost fold back their mouth, protrude their jaws, and so you just see the gums, there's probably a more scientific name for what they are, and the teeth just stick out. And in combination, at the same time, what they do is they can roll back their eyes so that there's a layer of cartilage comes over their eyes to protect their eyes, because, you know, they are struggling to survive in one of the most dangerous environments on Earth.
So they just happen to look satanic while they're doing it.
They look terrible, but actually, what they're doing is, you know, for a big, the worst thing that can happen to a big predator is to lose an eye, suffer some sort of a terrible injury. So they've actually, one scientist I spoke to, she suggested that the reason that they push their jaws so far forward is just gives a little bit of buffer between what they're slamming into and their brain.
It looks amazing. I've seen a photo. The skin around the, it doesn't, I don't know if you'd say there's lips or whatever, but the skin around the mouth seems to peel back as the whole jaw structure just starts to poke out. It's like an alien almost.
It reminds me of chop, chop, chop. And being there watching it, it reminded me of that Johnny Cash song, you know, Boy Named Sue. You know, I looked at him and my blood ran cold. You know, you sit there and your blood does run cold when you see that.
With all those teeth, do they actually chew on their prey in the water?
Look, it's actually really interesting what they do. Again, it depends across the sharks. But one of the things that, some researchers say is that with a great white is that, you know, that they come in and because they've got to be so careful about injuring themselves, that say if they're attacking a seal or, you know, some other big animal, that they'll come in and actually take the bite. And that animal will then bleed out. Because a shark doesn't want to end up in a fight with a really big seal.
Oh.
So they'll come in and they'll they're so well equipped to just, so when a tiger shark attacks a sea turtle, what actually happens is, you know, the energy that goes into that comes from the very back of its tail, and they're not afraid if a tooth falls out because their teeth just grow back. So a human can't go slamming into its prey because it can't afford to knock out teeth because they don't grow back. But a shark can. And what a shark will do when it's a tiger shark is attacking a turtle is that it's just trying to damage the shell.
Right, a death bite in a way.
To damage the shell.
Right.
So to affect the conformation, and then it can shake it, and then the shell, then it can start to get in. So
part of it is the teeth, but part of it is also the impact, the collision.
The
right.
impact is, and very much that's the case with a great white shark and attacking a seal. That's where you see that famous footage of, and scientists refer to it as a Polaris attack after the Polaris missiles from, I think it's a US submarine. So they'll come from the bottom, and so whatever's being attacked just won't even see it and just comes straight up, and you'll see the seals being just hit as if they've been hit by a truck and lifted into the air.
So they'll just hit and bite, or just hit?
And hit then and bite.
Hit yes. and bite, knock it out of the air, and what, pull back and wait for it to bleed to death?
Yeah, look, obviously, every situation is different, but yes, you know, they describe as humans as a chew and spit hypothesis, where it may just be that they're not sure what something is. They'll come in and they're being curious to find out what it is. The problem is for a human, you know, if you're a 1.7 meter tall human compared to a 5 meter great white shark, if they're being curious with you, that's a deadly thing or potentially a deadly thing.
Do many survivors actually see the shark that's mauled them?
Look, I found it really interesting when I spoke to John West, who runs the Australian Shark Attack File, and he actually said to me that They'll see the shark once they've been attacked, obviously, but often he said that it's the sharks that we don't see that are the ones that are most dangerous. And that's probably one of the biggest problems with our current kind of surveillance methods and shark mitigation methods is that, you know, the shark that's sitting on the surface that, you know, is clearly visible to lifesavers or to aerial patrols is probably not the shark that anyone has to worry about.
Right, it's the one lying down the bottom, like you say, like the Polaris sub that comes up.
Yeah, and just they are just such a stealthy and amazingly fast and powerful predator.
Tell me what happened on another dive you were on when you encountered a white shark called Mulga.
Mulga is an enormous male white shark that lives down in that we saw down in the Neptune Islands. And so he's a 5-meter white shark, which is about as big as a male white shark gets. And, you know, to get an idea of how that big that is, you take 5 big steps across a room and you'll see that there's very few rooms that Mulga would actually fit into. And he's, you know, the massive girth. And
Mulga would have to actually, in the studio we're in, would have to actually lie diagonally to fit into this room.
Yeah, I think he'd be struggling even diagonally.
Yeah, even diagonally. My word.
Right. And the thing was, so watching him, what was quite amazing is that he came up from the bottom and the power was really quite amazing.
And where were you?
I was in a cage at the surface. And so he came up from the bottom and I was with a group, Andrew Fox runs, it's the Fox Shark Research Foundation, and they do these amazing tours down in off South Australia. And this particular trip, I was just with scientists on one of Andrew's voyages. And the thing was, the shark at the very last second, before it looked like it was going to go through the surface, and I just didn't think it could possibly turn in any way that could be a threat to me. And so I was way too close to the window of the cage. And in fact, I had my camera just a little bit out and it turned, Mulga turned on a dime. You know, when a 5-meter, 1,000-kilogram animal turning on a dime, and it just came straight and it hit my hands and it knocked me, my camera sort of back, slammed into my face, knocked me back. And I think the thing that was most amazing to me was that I'd kind of imagine there'd be a little bit of give in a shark's nose. It was just like a being hit by a boulder of set concrete.
Wow. So you felt the nose of the shark. It just came
straight at my
your
camera
hands.
And hands. And I had my hands in front holding my camera case. And it just slammed into that, and there was absolutely no give whatsoever.
So you felt that sandy shark skin?
I didn't feel the sandy shark skin.
Of course you had your gloves on, right?
I didn't have gloves on, but it was just
hard.
Something that had absolutely no give. It was quite a while later at a shark autopsy that I actually got to feel a shark's nose.
So but you said it's really, really hard, but isn't it cartilage rather than bone?
It is cartilage.
So why so hard?
And that's one of one of the great mysteries of white shark research is how an animal is able to do so much and be one of the world's most ferocious predators with cartilage, which is effectively like gristle.
Bendy.
Yeah. And I actually spent a bit of time with a researcher at the University of New South Wales called Dr. Tony Ferrara, and she spent the last at least a decade working out how it is, because these big jaws that you see mounted, that is not what those are jaws that have had to be treated. They're actually quite soft.
The jaws of a shark are soft?
Well, the teeth aren't, but the jaws, actually, she describes it as the first time she pulled it out, they almost kind of like just melt away. Like they're really you can cut them with a Stanley knife. Whereas if you've got a mammal jaw, you need a saw.
Wow. So the bones, the jaws that we see have been treated to make them firm. But a real shark jaw cartilage, what, you can bend it and twist it?
Yeah, you can. And one of the things that I found really, really interesting about that as well is that a lot of the thing about that is that a mammal, you know, if it gets an injury to a bone, it can repair. Whereas what Tony was explaining to me is that, you know, fishermen, they'll pull out the hook from a shark jaws. And if they rip at all its jaws, there's, because inside the shark's jaws is this stuff that's like gel. And so it's very hard for, it's kind of like a shark hook is kind of kryptonite to a shark. And it's very hard for a shark's jaw to heal.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on your mobile.
Science journalist James Woodford is my guest. His latest book is called Great Whites. He's been diving with researchers off the coast of South Australia into one of the biggest shark aggregation sites in the world, which is, of course, meaning the place where a lot of sharks hang out when they're in the Southern Ocean. He's described the great white shark as a supersized goldfish with an inner line, which is undoubtedly true. We see them as these kind of super robotic death machines, which is, you know, silly, of course. Do they have personalities in any way or peculiarities?
I personally think this was one of the things that surprised me the most when I first started researching the sharks, that the fact that, you know, we see them as all kind of this homogenous thing, just all wanting to eat us. And what there's actually, if you go and you see, and I was very fortunate, I got to see a lot of different individual white sharks on a couple of different expeditions with scientists, and they all act differently.
Why? What kind of peculiarities do they have?
There's some, and Rachel Robbins, who's the chief scientist at the Fox Research Foundation, she can actually look at a shark and she knows its name, she knows what its personality will be like. She describes it, it's being like if you've got 50 border collies, an owner can still pick out their dog.
Ah.
So there's little idiosyncrasies in the way that they look. There might be a mark, and each one of the white sharks has a distinctive pattern of pigmentation on its flank. And
what about behavioural stuff, though?
And behavioural stuff, all the researchers talk about the fact that there are some sharks that seem calmer. There are some sharks that, you know, year after year, if you go down to somewhere like the Neptunes, you'll see them jumping, you know, breaching. There are other sharks that seem angry. There are other sharks that are particularly curious about the cage, and other sharks that, you know, really keep their distance. And a researcher, say, such as Charlie Houvenier's, it's called behavioural syndrome, and they would love to be able to do a study to kind of quantify this. But as it is, it's a very intangible thing and very hard to actually set up a research project. So it's just a thing that everybody senses, that these sharks do have unique personalities.
When I see them in the, you know, the Sydney Aquarium, and you see that those giant, huge tanks that have got about four sharks in them swimming around, I always think to myself, how are you guys getting on? Are they social, or are they largely individualistic?
They are largely individualistic. And in fact, they go to great lengths to avoid any kind of conflict or physical interactions between themselves. And so someone like Rachel, who's working with them every day, it's a rare thing to actually see sharks interact, particularly touching each other or anything like that. And so
do they tell each other, I'm coming into this area, keep out?
They do have, so the sharks do have a sort of a hierarchy of, you know, the big sharks, the dominant sharks. And so there is that dynamic going on, but it is not very well understood, and there's a lot more about white sharks that we don't know than what we do know.
So there is a hierarchy.
A hierarchy of sharks.
What happens when a stranger enters into a group of sharks then?
Well, the thing is, in that situation, the dominant sharks are obviously going to be keeping the less powerful sharks out of that area. So, again, it's one of these things that we're only just starting to understand about white sharks, and their social stuff, because they are so hard to study, and they are the environments where they live. You know, these are animals that go from swimming down to a more than a kilometre depth to a metre depth. They'll, you know, swim from Queensland down to Victoria and then across to New Zealand over the course of weeks. They are very, very hard to study, and the only way we're starting now to get a glimpse into their private lives is by these immense tagging programs.
Tagging sharks. Come here, darling, sit still while I put a receiver on you.
And watching the tags get put onto a white shark.
How do you do that?
It reminded me of being at a bull... not that I've ever been at a bullfight, but it reminded me a bit of a bullfight where you've got this bait on a rope that's thrown out from the back of the boat and they pull it in. And the thing is that the law is you're not allowed to let to feed white sharks. So you can't let the shark take the food. So they're pulling it in on the rope. And then you've got one of the scientists standing there like with a big kind of spear gun thing.
Looking for the angry, frustrated shark that's and just coming as towards
the,
you.
And just as the shark turns to avoid the boat, he drives the tag just into its side. And then for a moment, you just go, what is going to happen here? And you just see this immensely powerful animal suddenly just kind of writhe down into the depths. And it does look very, very brutal to the animals, but when you actually see some of the injuries that these guys have got from seals and other things, it's actually nothing. They recover very quickly.
With sharks, is there any way you can scare them, given that they're the apex predator pretty much wherever they are? Mm. Do they have any fear response to anything at all?
Oh, look, this is a really interesting thing. They are actually quite a timid animal. And when I spoke to, again, Charlie Hoveniers from Flinders Uni about this, he said it's like how an elephant will be scared of a mouse or a horse will be scared of some little animal. And if you think about it, it makes sense because you don't get to be, they're not the only dangerous animal in that environment. They have got to be very careful. They've got to be very certain. And it's not a forgiving environment. It's not like where we can just go down the supermarket and get food. Everything that they eat is absolutely central to their survival. They've got to be feeding and they can't afford to be injured. So they are actually very, very, very cautious.
We're sometimes told that, you know, it's dangerous to go into the water with an open wound because a shark, whatever it's doing, a kilometre away will go, hello, blood in the water, there's my prey. How true is that?
Andrew Fox, on my very first expedition with him, he explained that a lot of that is a myth. There is no kind of, they can't just smell it from a kilometre away. They've actually got to get into the trail of the blood molecules and then they'll be attracted in. But even there's quite a school of thought that human blood is so foreign to them.
They're not interested
in human blood.
The first time you went down in a cage with a couple of researchers, 17 kinds of things went wrong. Tell me that story. What happened?
Look, I had done hundreds of dives on my previous book on the Great Barrier Reef, but I'd never dived in a cage. And it's a really, in different circumstances, it can be quite an intimidating thing to do because it's a 500 kilogram cage. You're on this particular day, we're off a reef called an island called Liguania,
which is South Australia,
about 80 kilometres offshore. It was one of those, you know, charcoal sky days with big waves, and it was very, you know, very marginal as to whether the team would dive. And what they were doing is they'd already done a dive down before I went down, and they were looking to pick up a receiver that was on the seafloor that had been sitting there for months. But to get the receiver, you've actually got to open the cage door, swim out and go and get it and then come back into the cage.
In shark-infested waters.
But on the particular dive, they went down and there was great whites swimming around. So a decision was made not to actually go out of the cage. The cage got brought up to the surface. I had my turn to go down. And I'm one of these divers that I have to equalise quite slowly as on my first trip of every expedition.
You mean adjusting to the water pressure?
Yeah, adjusting to the water pressure. And so my ears hurt for the first few minutes of every dive. And on this particular occasion, I didn't probably communicate that clearly enough to the guy who was controlling the cage, and the cage descended too fast for my ears, and I blew out an eardrum. And
what happened when you blew out the eardrum?
The pain was really horrific, but the most horrific thing of all was this sensation that the cage was just spinning end over end.
Oh, and your inner ear was damaged or not functioning properly.
Well, I just had massive vertigo. And the cage, I'd first thought that the cable on the cage had broken and the cage was just free-falling. That's how it felt. Anyway, I got into a corner, worked out that everything was okay, held on, and got through the dive. It was really, really painful. But it basically meant that my diving for the rest of the expedition was done. I wouldn't be able to do any more bottom diving. And got up onto the surface. And so I had to sit out the next dive. And normally that kind of thing would really, really, you know, I hate missing out on stuff. But as it turned out, it was a very lucky thing because the scientists went back down again, this time just three divers because there was no one in my place. And they went down, they did their dive, they saw some more big great whites. And they came back up to the surface, took off their masks, took out their regulators, went to climb back onto the ship, and the cable actually really did snap on the cage, and the cage fell back into the sea.
Like an elevator with a broken
cable. Yeah, it was.
Were still inside the cage?
They were still inside the cage. And the thing is that, you know, without your regulator in, and in a situation like that, it's very hard to equalize. So everybody in the cage, and it dropped down 15 metres. It did have a safety rope attached, which stopped it falling any further. But so the cage fell down, and
did that mean everyone got the bends to some
degree? No, I mean it's not a great situation. It's more, you know, when they're coming up to the surface that that's going to be an issue. But the problem was that so they're down hanging on a rope instead of a steel cable. So it's obviously not as strong as the steel cable. The steel cable snapped.
They don't have the regulators in there.
So for the first, you know, 30 seconds, 40 seconds, people are putting their regs in, trying to clear their masks. And the thing about cage diving is you don't wear fins and you don't wear a buoyancy control vest. So the option of going outside of the cage and swimming to the surface, even in waters where there's no sharks, is not really available. And luckily Andrew, who's in charge of the expedition, he's an extremely experienced diver. He inflated a parachute that was in the cage, but they hadn't actually rehearsed that. Because this had just not ever happened before. They've never had an accident like this on any of their diving trips. And the cage actually came back up to the surface. But as soon as the parachute broke through the surface, it instantly deflated and the cage fell down again.
My God.
And anyway, I did this three or four times where they'd come up to the surface and the cage would then just instantly fall back down again. And every single time the divers, you know, their ears are just screaming and they, you know, they have a backup air supply tank, but there's not limitless air because they're at the end of their dive, not at the beginning of their dive. And finally, the skipper of the ship managed to lower down a weight belt with the snapped steel cable down to the cage. Andrew was actually able to hand tie the cable, and the ship's crew slowly winched the cable back up. And so that the terrible choice of maybe having to get out of the cage was, you know, averted. They had some other backup redundancy before they would have had to swim. And Andrew's, you know, he's fairly confident that the sharks would have been so mystified about what everyone was doing that they probably would have got to the surface safely anyway. But it's that kind of experience that it's a nightmare scenario. No, and I think that's one of the common things with shark attacks is they often happen. People aren't expecting to be in a situation. You know, no one went to work that day thinking they're going to end up in a cage dangling on the Southern Ocean.
What were the researchers like once they got back into the boat at last?
Everyone was really chastened. And, you know, there was the look of fear in the people's eyes and I guess just the pain and the shock. It was a really somber experience. And of course, for Andrew, he has completely overhauled and changed a lot of his procedures to make sure that something like that just can't happen again.
James, you witnessed the dissection of a white shark. Tell me where this happened.
Yeah, that happened at the Cronulla. There's a fisheries research centre. It's now been closed down, but it's at Cronulla. Not actually at the beach, but I think it's Port Hacking there. And it's a headland there. And this particular shark had been caught down at a place called Coaldale, which is on the Illawarra coast, just north of Wollongong. And it had been caught in beach meshing nets. And so it's so rare to actually get a great white shark that each one is very precious to science. So they actually put it into a freezer. And then as soon as the lead Australian scientist, Dr. Barry Bruce from the CSIRO, is able to, he comes up and dissects it. And I was very lucky to be able to witness the dissection with Barry and a New South Wales scientist called Vic Pettimores. And, that was my very first chance to actually touch a great white shark, to feel that that skin, to feel what its nose actually felt like.
But yeah, what was the nose on this one like?
The nose on this one was more like what I expected. It had give and it was kind of pudgy. And I guess one of the things that scientists describe it as, it's that, you know, when you get corn flour and you add water to it, and if you hit it, it acts like a solid. It's maybe a bit like that. It's going at such speed, and when it hits something, instead of acting like a fluid, which the stuff inside a shark's jaws is actually more like, it actually acts like a real solid. So, but because this thing was stationary on a bench in an outside laboratory, it was just soft and pudgy, and then seeing this thing be cut open and finally getting to the inside of this story of what actually, because the idea of my book, I said I wouldn't do a book about shark attacks. I wanted to do a book about
sharks.
What kind of an animal actually are they? And this was absolutely fascinating.
Yes. So that moment where the first incision happens along the flank of the shark. And what do you see when you see inside a shark?
Look, the really surprising thing is they've got this enormous liver. Barry was like having to manhandle this thing out. It's a huge thing, and it looks like a great big caramel dessert from it's really disgusting, and you actually
slightly less flavoursome, of course.
And you really wonder who's the bad guys here, the sharks or us? And because Barry looked like a combination of a surgeon. A mortician, it was just a very totally surreal thing. But then when he got to the stomach, he could tell that there was something in there and something quite big.
And were you dreading what you might see next?
Yeah. And he obviously hams it up a little bit and it kind of picks up the stomach, squeezes it out. And that was like being at a cesarean. I don't know if you've ever been to a cesarean, but it was this quite a rough process, and then out pops this, slaps down on the table the remains of this 75-centimetre blue groper that the shark had eaten, and just flopped down onto the table. And the scientists were really excited about that.
Why were they so excited?
Because they, it's another glimpse into what these sharks are eating. Blue gropers are a reef fish.
So, and was it partly digested or chopped up, or
it was whole in the
whole
sense that the soft bits around its stomach had been digested, but the skeleton and head came out in one great big piece. And and I'll never forget the sound as it sort of flopped onto the table. And it really was, because you just don't know what it's going to be.
When I've seen animal autopsies on SBS, which is a strangely compelling thing to watch, you have that first moment where you think your head's about to explode with the kind of shock and disgust, and then of course that passes, and then all you do is you're just filled with wonder at the sight of it all. Were you filled with that sense?
I was in a sort of a strange reverse way, though. I felt like, given how amazing these animals are and the incredible things that they can do and their sophistication, which always surprises everybody, that, And the fact that they look so much like a Hollywood animatronics, you know, robotic thing, that, you know, inside there must be some kind of gadgetry and wizardry.
Like a control panel and lights and...
Yeah. And the actual sensation that I got was very similar to the very first time I opened up the bonnet of an E.H. Holden that we owned. And when I looked inside, the engine of this E.H. Holden was so small and simple. And that's the impression you get from when you look at a white shark, that evolution has spent hundreds of millions of years creating this absolutely perfect but utterly simple predator, and that just works so well. So you're talking about muscle, stomach, jaws, very simple animal.
Did you see its brain?
Yes.
How big is the brain?
The brain, that was a really big shock to me because the first thing that the scientist, Barry, gave to me, put right in my hand, was its eyes. And they're like kind of billiard ball size things. They're huge. And then you're getting into the brain. He's got to cut through all this, the cartilaginous brain casing. And the brain is the size of my thumb. So they've got this really, really tiny. Well, comparatively, it's big compared to some sharks. But I think a lot of people, and I was certainly very, very surprised that they do so much with such a small brain.
And given it's a fish and not a mammal, does its brain look anything like ours? Is it sort of wrinkled and grey?
No, it didn't. It's kind of a longer thing. It actually is very, it reminded me a lot of my thumb.
What do we know about the way sharks can predict cyclones?
Yeah, this was a really, I found this to be, because one of the myths of sharks is that these guys are unsophisticated, that they're just out there, you know, looking to chow down on people and whatever's going past. But I was in Townsville when Cyclone Yasi came through, and there was a researcher who had some sharks that were tagged in Cleveland Bay. And what actually happened was the day before the cyclone, so, you know, I was living there that day, and until the cyclone actually arrived, you wouldn't have known it was coming. It was beautiful, people going about their business, but the sharks knew. And so all of his tagged sharks, and these aren't white sharks, there's a whole lot of different species, but they all took off into deep water. So not only are these guys master navigators that can make a beeline, you know, from one continent to another, go down to these incredible depths, they can use the sun as a way to assist them with catching prey, but also they've got an inbuilt weather station. So there's somehow some mechanism that we're not fully aware of. And the most interesting thing is because there was a smaller cyclone that came through a couple of months earlier, and they knew that the earlier cyclone was not going to pose a threat to them, and they stayed. But for Cyclone Yasi,
they got out.
They actually left, and they went right out to deeper water.
Maybe it's something that can in a device that can detect changes in water pressure, air pressure, air, water currents, that kind of thing.
But I think, you know, it's lovely that there are still some mysteries about these things, but I think the most important thing is that we're talking about a really impressive animal that is so much more than people realise. And I guess, in a way, they sort of tell a story. And my current job, I'm working... funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts as an ocean correspondent, it's all about highlighting the wonders of Australia's marine environment, and great white sharks are definitely one of those wonders.
We know those stories about the five attacks over a two-year period in Western Australia, the ones that goaded the WA government into a culling program. Mm. What do you think about all that?
I think culling of white sharks or any sharks is actually the only thing it does is make politicians and the public feel better about themselves. And it gives a false sense of safety, and it probably diverts money away from things that could actually be done and research that could be done to really assist in saving lives. The Professor Jessica Maywig, I was talking to her a couple of weeks ago. She's a shark expert from Western Australia. And her most simple point is they caught no white sharks in that culling program by drum lines, but they caught 163 tiger sharks. And a lot of them were really big tiger sharks. The problem is there has not been a tiger shark fatality in Western Australia since the 1920s. So, you know, what that all that that drumline program proved is that tiger sharks and people are coexisting perfectly lovely.
You think there's a punitive element in all of this? Like, you know, we must strike back at the sharks, otherwise word will spread through the shark community that Australia is weak.
And, you know, it gives politicians a chance to stand with a great big hook. Mm. But really, we need to be looking at the amazing work of people like Rachel Robbins, you know, who day after day are out there learning about the sharks, tagging them, and that's how we'll find out, you know, what we can do to mitigate the risk of being taken by a shark.
Great to speak with you, James. Good luck on your next cage dive. I hope you're a bit warier about that these days. But, nonetheless, it's been fantastic to speak with you. And
thanks very much, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.